You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is a combined issue for December of 2022 and January of 2023. And this is Vanity Fair, Part A. Now for the cover story, Marvelous Margot. This season, Margot Robbie is set to dazzle as a silent movie star in Damien Chazelle's Babylon. And next year, as a Barbie for the 21st century in Greta Gerwig's highly anticipated movie, which she's also producing. She opens up about her story and Hollywood's. By Rebecca Ford. With photographs by Mario Sorrenti, styled by Anastasia Barbieri. In the photos, class act. Margot Robbie, photographed by Vanity Fair in Paris on September 23rd, and she's wearing various high fashion outfits. Margot Robbie wants to take me to New York. We're on the Paramount lot in Los Angeles, and she's giving me a walking tour of some places they shot Babylon, her upcoming movie about the vertiginous swirl that was Hollywood in the late 1920s. We're about to enter the New York back lot. Faux neighborhoods used as stand-ins for various cities. When a security guard stops us with an, "Excuse me, where are you heading?" We try saying, "That way," and walk like we own the place. The guard isn't buying it. He asks what production we're with. This is where I expect my tour guide to say, "I'm Margot Robbie." Instead, she mumbles something about being with Babylon and doing some post. Then her voice trails off. The security guard clearly doesn't recognize that standing in front of him is the Australian actor who brought Harley Quinn to life and was nominated for an Oscar for playing Tonya Harding. He tells us we have to get off the set because somebody's shooting. Robbie politely agrees. She laughs as we round the corner. "I should have a better cover story," she says. "You'd think I'd be better at that." I actually have a hard time believing that Robbie runs up against Hard Nose very often. Not because of her looks. She's stunning, yes. That song's been sung ad nauseum. But because of the stories I've heard about her tenacity. Her first big job on the Australian soap opera Neighbours was supposed to be a guest stint, but she made such an impression that they kept her for 3 years. Robbie got her breakout role in The Wolf of Wall Street in part because she had the chutzpah to slap Leonardo DiCaprio during the audition. And she wrote an unsolicited letter to Quentin Tarantino saying she hoped to work with him one day, eventually finding herself on the set of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Everyone I speak to about Robbie emphasizes her work ethic. Her superpower and the thing that makes her a once-in-a-generation talent is that she can do everything, says Christina Hodson, a good friend and the writer of the 2020 Suicide Squad spinoff, Birds of Prey. If you watch Margot learn a new skill, it's pretty terrifying. When we did stunts for Birds of Prey, the stunt teams would show something to her. Once. She tries it once, and by the second time, she's better than them. Robbie's I, Tonya co-star Allison Janney has said she reminds her of Katharine Hepburn, who put together the Philadelphia story herself when she felt she wasn't getting the roles she deserved. Martin Scorsese says she reminds him of two legends, Carol Lombard and Joan Crawford. Like Lombard, she's vivacious, strikingly beautiful, and she has a great sense of humor, about herself most of all. Like Crawford, she's completely grounded and instantly commanding. She enters the frame, and you pay attention to her. It's fitting, then, that Robbie plays a fictional Hollywood icon on the rise in Babylon, Paramount's epic comedy drama led by Robbie, Brad Pitt, and newcomer Diego Calva. The movie, which hits theaters on December 23rd, is set during the industry's wildest time, when the money was flowing, the rules were few, and the possibilities of fame and success felt endless. From the hour or so I've seen, it aspires to be a kaleidoscopic look at the movie business, just as talkies were about to upend the industry forever. Babylon aims to capture the decadence and depravity of the era, along with the madness and, not to sound like Nicole Kidman in that AMC ad, the magic of filmmaking. What you see on screen is the chaos of making a movie and how effed it is, but also how it's just the greatest thing ever, Robbie says of Babylon. And literally, filming it was the exact same thing. Shit was so unhinged and so fun and amazing and just absurd. It was definitely the best experience of my life. Robbie may be sitting with me because she has a movie to promote, but for the record, I believe her. Babylon's Nellie LeRoy is arguably the closest character she's ever played to herself. Nellie is an outsider in Hollywood, full of spice and vigor and an untamable energy. She stumbles into her first role with some luck, but delivers a performance so singular that it sets her on a path to stardom. Margot is able to tap into this wildness and this bravado where you don't know what's going to come, and it keeps surprising you, says Damien Chazelle, who directed Babylon. Usually, when you think of actors with that kind of raw energy, it's an unschooled energy. With Margot, that's not the case at all. She's a tornado, in other words, with actual technique. Like Nellie, Robbie, who's 32, got Hollywood's attention with a breakout performance in The Wolf of Wall Street and has built a career that suggests what a modern movie star can be. She's a no-bullshit actor and producer who bounces between blockbusters and dark indies, even if she's still a little uncomfortable with the spotlight. The way I try to explain this job and this world to people is that the highs are really high, she says, her hand hovering over her head, and the lows are really, really low. And I guess if you're lucky, it all balances out in the middle. Robbie is wearing an oversized black jacket on top of a black tank and wide-legged brown plaid pants, schlepping an armful of notebooks and books. That's likely why, when three golf carts full of tourists drive by, nobody notices her. As we wander around the lot, we talk about how wild it is that 100 years' worth of stars have trod these same walkways, among them Clara Bow, the silent era movie icon. Bow was the first It Girl, a sex symbol and Paramount's top box office draw for several years, starring in 46 silent movies, including 1927's Wings, the first film to win Best Picture. Bow is also the primary inspiration for Nellie LeRoy in Babylon. Robbie studied her movies, and in particular, her early years. Whenever I'm trying to make a character, I have to figure out their childhood. I can justify anything they do later in life if I just figure that out, she says. Once Robbie learned how traumatic Bow's youth was, full of violence and poverty, as well as abuse by her mentally ill mother, she understood what drove Nellie to escape into the movies. She had probably the most horrific childhood I can imagine for anyone, she says. You can justify anything Nellie does and says in this movie if you imagine that she experienced something like that as a kid. Robbie works with a movement coach to find animals that inspire her character's physicality. Hey, whatever works. And tells me that Nellie's animals were an octopus and a honey badger, because she's fluid and tactile, but ruthless when necessary. Robbie opens a black notebook and reads some lines about octopuses. They're liquid, they're playful, highly intelligent, great survivors, transformative, can morph into anything. I can attest that the octopus made its presence felt in a party scene early on, in which Nellie, clad in a skin-tight red dress and having just availed herself of some cocaine, moves through the crowd in a writhing, libidinous dance. The honey badger emerges later during fights. Robbie closes her notebook. I wish I had my character map, too, she says, because that would make you feel sure that I was a crazy person if you saw that. Nellie is sexy in an unforced way. At one point, Robbie is wearing overalls without a top, an outfit inspired by a look Beau once wore, and she's got at least a couple scantily clad moments in the film, though that doesn't please her. She showed just about all the skin she has in The Wolf of Wall Street. I don't really have a whole lot of modesty left, Robbie says, laughing, then adds that she can separate herself from her characters. I don't feel embarrassed when it's Nellie doing something. I'd feel embarrassed if it was me, but it's all her. That party scene required Robbie to dance 8 hours straight on 2 successive days. Calva says when the scene wrapped, all the crew, dancers, and musicians applauded her. She just gave everything she had. Everything's raw. She's a fearless actress. Adam McKay, who directed Robbie in a highly memorable scene in The Big Short, in which she explains mortgage-backed bonds while enjoying a bubble bath, agrees that Robbie's commitment is one of her greatest strengths, along with the ever-present life in her eyes. With Margot, anything she's going to do will be 24/7, head to toe, he says. But what's so cool about it is that there's a sense of humor behind it. There's a playfulness that's kind of irresistible. Before touring the lot, Robbie and I sit in the front row of the Paramount Theater, the gorgeous 500-seat movie house that's just past the lot's iconic fountain and ornate entrance gate. Her hair is now a few shades darker than the bright blonde we've seen on screen. Her books and notebooks sit piled on her lap. Robbie tells me about her childhood in Queensland, Australia, where her single mom raised her and her 3 siblings. I grew up in a very loud, busy house, and so I feel safe and comfortable when there's just chaos around me, she says. I think it's why I love movie sets. She hates being alone, she adds, and often invites friends to hang out in her trailer between takes. After Neighbors, Robbie moved to the States and played a flight attendant on the ABC series Pan Am. The show only lasted a season, but then she nabbed the role of blonde bombshell Naomi LaPaglia in Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street. Robbie wasn't prepared to be an it girl herself. Fame was instantaneous and intense. Robbie wasn't emotionally ready for the loss of privacy, and financial security was still a ways off. She tells me it was one of her lowest moments. Something was happening in those early stages, and it was all pretty awful, and I remember saying to my mom, I don't think I want to do this. And she just looked at me completely straight-faced and was like, darling, I think it's too late not to. That's when I realized the only way was forward. Robbie has a better handle on navigating fame. I know how to go through airports, and now I know who's trying to F me over in what ways, she says. But there are still bumps. Before our interview, Robbie was on vacation in Argentina when a paparazzo reportedly attempted to take pictures of her and her friend Cara Delevingne as they tried to get into a taxi. Initial reports stated that Robbie had been injured. When I ask about the episode, she says she can't say anything because of ongoing legal issues between other parties involved. I ask her if she was hurt, and she says no, but I could have been. Internationally, she tells me, there aren't rules protecting public figures like there are in L.A. Robbie's family in Australia has been swept up in dangerous situations while being pursued by photographers. If my mom dies in a car accident because you wanted a photo of me going in the grocery shop, or you knock my nephew off a bike, for what? For a photo? She says. It's dangerous, but still weirdly nothing feels like it changes. This fall, Robbie's mom called her after paparazzi purportedly captured Robbie crying outside of De Levine's L.A. home. Tabloids theorized that Robbie was worried about her friend and Suicide Squad co-star, who'd recently been photographed looking upset. So her mom called. Was Margot all right? Was Kara? I'm like, first of all, yes and yes, says Robbie, exasperated. And second of all, I'm not at Kara's house. I'm outside an Airbnb that I was renting for 5 days. And I'm not crying. I had something in my eye. I'm trying to grab my face mask, trying to hold a coffee cup, and I couldn't get a hair out of my eye. Before she was in this business, Robbie assumed that the press only printed the truth. Then tabloids started routinely announcing that she was pregnant when she wasn't, and people called to congratulate her. Eventually, Robbie made peace with the fact that she can't refute every false story, a Sisyphean task if there ever was one. You want to correct it, but you just can't. You have to, I don't know, look the other way. As for interviews, she admits that junkets stress her out. They only want sound bites, and I don't resent them for it. I get it. They've got 3 minutes, she says. But it's like tap dancing through a minefield because you're so tired and you've done it for hours and hours, and to keep on guard all the time. You can say it right 1,000 times, but you say it wrong once, you're effed. When I meet with her, Robbie has just completed the press tour for David O. Russell's Amsterdam, a quirky movie set in the 30s, in which she stars opposite Christian Bale and John David Washington. Russell is known for his, shall we say, intense nature on set. For starters, he made Amy Adams cry while making American Hustle, and screamed profanely at Lily Tomlin on the set of I Heart Huckabees in a video so horrific that it's now the stuff of legend. I ask if Robbie had any trepidation about working with him, especially in this new Hollywood where ideally toxic behavior isn't tolerated. The process with David started years ago, she says, adding that they created her character together. One conversation led to another conversation, led to another conversation that went on for years and years. So it wasn't like a moment of, like, would you sign up for a David O. Russell film? She appreciated the brainstorming, she says. I've never been that involved, just as an actor. I've never had a director want to hear my point of view that much in the development process. I ask if the set was ever uncomfortable. She shakes her head. No. I had a pretty amazing experience, she says. The other thing I wish people could grasp is that when you make a movie, you're not making it just with one director and the actors. You're making a movie with so many people. She singles out the Oscar-winning cinematographer Emmanuel Chivo Lubezki and says that working with him was one of the absolute highlights of her career. As we talk, Robbie is open and generous, often digressing into passionate stories about her on-set experiences or favorite movies or podcast. She loves Team Deakins, a movie-making podcast featuring cinematographer Roger Deakins and his wife, James Ellis Deakins. She's more careful when we veer into her personal life. It's such an ironic thing, she says. When you're an actor, the whole point is that you're showing people other people. So it's such a counterintuitive thing to talk about yourself when you spend all this time hiding yourself. Still, she seems to be hiding nothing more than human decency. She paid off her mom's mortgage with her first big paycheck and a fondness for having a good time with friends. She takes girls surfing trips to Nicaragua and group vacations to Spain. A few more details that suggest we're dealing with an actual 3D person here. Robbie can open a beer bottle with another beer bottle. She wants to learn to play the banjo. She threw a Love Island-themed birthday party. She really loves Love Island, which is surprising just because she's very classy, says Hodson. But yes, that is definitely a guilty pleasure that we waste many, many hours on. At one point, Robbie says she wishes she could have been an actor in the 20s or even the 70s, but she's been able to play a variety of roles, putting boils on her face to play Queen Elizabeth I in Mary, Queen of Scots, wearing ice skates and a padded bodysuit for Tanya Harding, and employing garish face paint and a baseball bat for Harley Quinn, while also producing the sort of projects she longed for. Clara Bow could only play one type of character and had little control over her career, which I can say with certainty would not sit well with Robbie. She pulls out another notebook and reads Walt Whitman. "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." She looks up and smiles. "I contain multitudes is a cool thing to remind yourself." Hollywood didn't expect her to contain multitudes. When she rose to prominence after Wolf of Wall Street at 22, Robbie was offered the predictable hot blonde roles, all of which she turned down. I tell her that Hollywood loves to put ingenues in a box, and she goes further. I think people love to put people in boxes. Even now, Robbie doesn't get enough credit for her work as a producer. In 2014, she founded Lucky Chap Entertainment with three of her closest friends. One of them, Tom Ackerley, became her husband in 2016. The company's first release was 2017's I, Tanya, a critical hit that earned three Oscar nominations and a win for Janny. In 2021, Promising Young Woman brought in five more Oscar nominations and a screenwriting win for Emerald Fennell. The company, which champions female stories and storytellers, produced five movies this year, including the next film from Fennell. And then there's Barbie. The movie was essentially dead after shuffling through lead actors, Amy Schumer and Anne Hathaway, and writers until Robbie signed on to star and produce. She brought in Greta Gerwig to co-write with her partner Noah Baumbach and direct, aiming for a subversive take on the movies on the world's most iconic doll. Making an obvious Barbie movie would have been extremely easy to do, says Robbie, and anything easy to do is probably not worth doing. Gerwig was impressed by Robbie to the point of being dumbfounded. "Once, I wanted to capture Margot in slow motion, but have everything else move fast. So I went up to her and said, 'Could you move at 48 frames per second, even though we're shooting in 24 frames per second, and everyone else will be moving at regular speed?'" She did some calculation behind her eyes and then effing did it. She literally moved at a higher frame rate. I don't know what category that goes into other than magic. Robbie's aware that there are lots of eyes on this movie, which she experienced firsthand while shooting in Venice Beach with her co-star Ryan Gosling in neon spandex and rollerblades. "People have got strong feelings. I'd much rather that than indifference. Now, let me subvert your expectations. It's much scarier, but it's also a great place to begin." Robbie, to be clear, is a true working producer. She's in those pre-production meetings. She's on set. She's putting out fires and getting yelled at by agents. "When I point out that many actors who get producer credits don't actually do any producing," she says, "yeah, that pissed me off. It's so annoying. Because I have to fight every time." By fight, she means fight to be taken seriously as a producer. Early in every project, she's kept off email chains or not invited to calls because some people assume it's just a vanity title for her. Then everyone realizes after a few months, "Oh, she actually is a producer," she says. "But even still, people direct all the money questions at my producing partners, never at me. And so many times, Tom and Josie have to say, 'She's the one to ask, actually.'" We've wandered down nearly every street on the Paramount lot. Robbie has shown me where she did months of dance rehearsal, plus clown school for Babylon, and where she filmed one of her favorite scenes, a vicious full-tilt fight between her character and Calva's. She accidentally broke a window and bruised Calva's ribs, and then the scene was cut from the movie. Robbie has shared some of the 31 accents she tried on for Nellie by playing recordings on her phone. In one, she sounds exactly like Fran Drescher. In another, it's Jersey Shore's Snooki meets Joe Pesci. They eventually settled on a Jersey accent with a bit of a hard partier's rasp. When Babylon wrapped, Robbie was at loose ends. It was the most physically and emotionally draining character I've ever played, by a country mile. She demands so much of you that she left me in pieces. Robbie and her husband are now moving into a new home in L.A. They also have a place in London, and on top of the 5 films she's producing, she's readying Barbie for next summer. Robbie's also in pre-production on an Ocean's 11 prequel that she'll star in and produce. Another franchise spinoff she'd been attached to, a Pirates of the Caribbean film, is dead, she tells me. We had an idea, and we were developing it for a while, ages ago, to have more of a female-led, not totally female-led, but just a different kind of story, which we thought would have been really cool, but I guess they don't want to do it, she says of Disney. There are directors she still hopes to work with, of course, Paul Thomas Anderson, Bong Joon-ho, and Celine Sciamma. But more than anything, Robbie's focus is on legacy. She talks about the films she watches and re-watches on her movie nights with her husband and friends, the ones from the 20s or 70s that decades and decades on can still hit you all over again. Robbie will make her share of them, too. Just you watch.
Thank you.
the voice. Naomi Aki, the dazzling British actor playing Whitney Houston in a new Hollywood biopic, opens up about her surprising road from drama school to Star Wars to the greatest love of all, by Johanna Desta, with photographs by Ruth Osai, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. In the high fashion photos, star turn. Naomi Aki photographed in London in September. Halloween 2021. Naomi Aki had fully nailed Whitney Houston's look from the music video for I Will Always Love You. The black suit, the coiffed hair, and the red lips. Iconic, she says. Aki wasn't going to a costume party. She was doing her millionth callback for the lead role in the Houston biopic I Wanna Dance With Somebody. The British actor, who broke out in films like Lady Macbeth and Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, had initially resisted pursuing the role. I was like, absolutely not. That is too big. But her team talked her into it. So there she was auditioning, wearing sleek Houstonian drag and belting the voice's signature ballad. 2 months later, when Aki was shooting the third season of Master of None, her agents showed up at her London home unannounced, blasting I Wanna Dance With Somebody from a speaker. That's how she learned that she'd snagged the role. They celebrated with a socially distanced champagne toast, sprawling out on cushions in the hallway. Then Aki had a realization. She had landed the part. Now she had to play it. That took a long time to get my head around, she says. Aki had never played someone as legendary as Houston before, or even led a film. She first started acting at 11, later training at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. Back then, she had a wildly different career ambition to run a theater company. Her thinking, she says, was as follows. I'm going to concentrate on making really cool, small pieces of work, and maybe one day I can do Broadway. But then her screen career kept ascending. Aki won a BAFTA for her murderously good turn in the Netflix series The End of the Effing World, then played the resistance fighter Janna in the most recent Star Wars film. At the time, she was cast by Lucasfilm. Aki was 26 and still living at home with her father, who's her biggest supporter, slowly reckoning with the ways her life was transforming. I Wanna Dance With Somebody is her latest transformation. Directed by Casey Lemons and written by Anthony McCartan, Bohemian Rhapsody, the biopic traces Houston's life from her upbringing in New Jersey, where her mother, Sissy Houston, an established soul singer, gave her vocal lessons. Though the film wasn't finished, when Aki spoke to Vanity Fair, even select scenes make clear that it covers the turning points in Houston's life and career, including her first meeting with industry legend Clive Davis, Stanley Tucci, her tempestuous marriage to Bobby Brown, and the birth of their daughter, Bobby Christina. The film also, Aki says, tackles Houston's drug addiction, which contributed to her accidental death by drowning in 2012 at just 48 years old. This project was about honoring her legacy, and I think there has to be a real balance of the light and dark in that, Aki says. She's seen a rough cut of the film and left feeling grateful for what Houston gave us, without feeling too weighed down by the intricacies of her struggle with addiction. But it's a part of her life, and that has to be acknowledged. To prepare for the role, Aki gave herself a 6-month berth and read everything she could, including A Song for You, a memoir by Robin Crawford, one of Houston's closest friends and collaborators. In the book, Crawford writes tenderly about their relationship, claiming she and Houston were lovers. We never talked about labels, like lesbian or gay. We just lived our lives, and I hoped it could go on that way forever. Houston, a devout Christian, ended their romance before her career took off, gifting Crawford a Bible and telling her to keep it a secret. Still, they stayed close. Crawford became Houston's assistant and later her creative director. Akey speaks delicately about the relationship, not wanting to reveal how the biopic handles that narrative. Nafessa Williams portrays Crawford in the film. "I don't feel like it's my place to put a label on it," Akey says, "but this film definitely touches on what could have been." Akey spoke to numerous people who knew Houston, including Davis and Whitney's brother Gary. She worked with a dialect coach to nail Houston's accent, creating video playlists of Houston's speaking voice in her youth, middle age, and final years to better mimic her vocal depth. She kept the accent on set between scenes, leaning on the film's hair and makeup team to keep her honest. She finally perfected it after coming into their trailer one day, fuming about something that had pissed her off. "I'm still in character and I'm talking shit." And suddenly they all went, "Yo," Akey burst out laughing. That's when it all clicked. Perfecting the voice was essential. With her high, cherubic cheekbones and gap-toothed grin, she doesn't pass for Houston, even with movie magic. "I don't look like Whitney. I know I don't," Akey says. She worked past that, focusing on their commonalities. "We run on the same rhythm." When filming wrapped, it took Akey time to shake the role off. "I felt, by the end, this love-hate situation with taking on this responsibility," she says. "I want to stay and hold on tightly to it, but I also need to go." She took a restorative break, then leapt into her next project, Zoe Kravitz's directorial debut, about a cocktail server invited to a mogul's private isle of moneyed hedonism. "Zoe is a force," Akey says. "We spent 3 months in Mexico making this thriller horror about power. It's probably one of the wildest films I've ever done." After that, she dove straight into Bong Joon-ho's Mickey 7. The secretive sci-fi project is the Oscar-winning director's return to film after the staggering success of Parasite. "He's just so warm and smart," Akey says. "I felt myself surrendering to his plan." She can't say much about the film, a defining facet of this chapter of her life, where all her projects are the rarefied hush-hush sort. "You pinch yourself a little bit," she says. "It's this weird feeling. You're plodding along, and then suddenly you look back at where you've come from, and you're like, oh my gosh, it's been a really long journey." incident to service. For more than 70 years, an obscure legal doctrine has prevented active duty service members from suing the federal government for wrongful injury or death occurring outside of combat. Jurists left and right have long lamented the decision and begged for Congress to act. So why is justice that's available to every American civilian still being denied those who serve our nation? By Maximilian Potter. Opening photos, Army Master Sergeant Richard Staskel on deployment in Iraq, 2009. And Army Specialist Des Del Barba, January 2019. In 2018, 21-year-old Des Del Barba had put his plan for the rest of his life in motion. A senior at Sonoma State University, Des had set his sights on becoming an officer in the United States Army. Already, he had been accepted into officer candidate school and was on his way to completing the necessary prerequisite of basic training. To get a jump on basic, Des enlisted in the Army National Guard and obtained a leave from Sonoma State for a semester of his senior year. After basic, he would finish his degree in business management while serving in the National Guard. Then, upon graduation, he would immediately transition to Army active duty and the path to becoming an officer. This planning and hustle was classic Des. He had graduated from Lincoln High School in his hometown of Stockton, California, in 2015 with honors and as a lacrosse star. His senior year with the Lincoln Trojans, he earned the team's offensive MVP honors. At Sonoma State, he continued his academic excellence and stayed fit as a gym rat. When I met with Des's parents, Mark and Camney, at their home in Stockton in the winter of 2022, Mark had recently retired after 21 years as a corrections officer. I asked if he'd ever taken Des to work to scare his son straight. There wasn't ever any need, Mark replied without hesitation. Des just always did the right thing. Mark and Camney had ample reason to believe their only son would thrive in the Army. They were a military family. Camney had served in the active duty Army National Guard for 23 years, including a deployment to Iraq in 2010. Her sister is an Army Lieutenant Colonel. Mark's father was a Marine. Seated on the couch next to her husband in their living room, Camney talked about how her parents immigrated from India when she was a child and how grateful she is to this country. That was a big part of what inspired me to enlist, she said. Mark and Camney accepted that one day Des might be deployed to combat risk zones, but, Camney told me, we never thought the Army would do to our son what they did to our son. Des began basic at Fort Benning, Georgia, in January 2019. According to the Army's own investigation of what later happened, he did well during his first 5 weeks. Private First Class Del Barba was motivated and always willing to train. We never had any issues from him, one drill sergeant wrote in his sworn statement. Most names in the report are redacted. Was a hard worker, another drill sergeant wrote, always pushing members of his team. On February 2nd, only a few weeks after he left for basic, Mark and Camney received a letter from Des. He wrote that one of his fellow trainees died of a heart attack, leaving behind a baby and a pregnant wife. Camney chalked it up to an avoidable tragedy. The Del Barbas next heard from Des on February 3rd, a phone call on Super Bowl Sunday. Mark thought his son's voice sounded hoarse and asked him if everything was okay. Yeah, Des said, just there's a lot of screaming and yelling. Made sense, Mark told me. You're in basic training. There's yelling. Camney added, we did tell him to go to the doctor. 8 days later, on the morning of February 11th, Mark and Camney got another call from Fort Benning. Des was in the hospital. Within hours, a friend was driving them to the San Francisco airport, and they were on the phone with a doctor at Piedmont Columbus Regional Midtown Hospital. The doctor informed them Dez was going into emergency surgery. He said that Dez had necrotizing fasciitis, a flesh-eating bacterial infection that spreads rapidly. The surgery would be for debridement, to remove infected skin and tissue, hopefully to stop the spread. The mortality rate for such an infection is around 25%. Without rapid diagnosis, surgery, and treatment, death is a virtual certainty. After the call, Mark and Camney began asking each other questions. "How does he get a flesh-eating disease?" Mark told me, recalling that conversation. He emphasized certain words to convey their concern and confusion. Was it in the mud? How does he get a flesh-eating disease? As Mark and Camney talked about their son, they took turns without prompting. When one spoke, the other listened. I asked if there was a backstory behind the name Dez. Mark, a stocky guy with a youthful face, who wore an unbuttoned flannel over a t-shirt and blue Vans, said that growing up, his favorite band was the punk group Black Flag. One of the lead singers was Dez Cadena. Camney agreed to let Mark go with the name. On the couch, the parents looked at each other. Then Mark said, "We gave the army a healthy, athletic, beautiful young man." His voice wilted. He tried hard not to cry. In the year following Dez's diagnosis, he endured more than 40 skin grafting procedures and 2 amputations on his left leg. More than 50% of his skin was replaced. His left leg from just above the knee was removed. The kid, who had been so full of purpose and so optimistic about his future, attempted suicide. Throughout all of it, the Del Barbas cared for their son, trying hard to maintain their hope and sanity. Eventually, they began to piece together answers to their questions about how their son became sick. In early February 2019, Dez contracted a common case of strep throat, easily treatable with antibiotics, and one that Mark and Camney later learned base command and medical staff should have been especially vigilant against. The trainee who had died suddenly, that Dez had written home about, was 22-year-old Christopher Huss. The Del Barbas later obtained his autopsy report. His fatal heart attack was due to cardiac arrhythmia. Contributing factors included strep and influenza. Huss died on January 22, 2019, a couple of weeks before Dez began making almost daily trips to base medical services, presenting symptoms consistent with a quickly intensifying case of strep. Mark and Camney learned that rather than appropriately examining Dez, medical staff blew him off and sent him back to training, once examining him for less than 3 minutes, once refusing to see him at all. According to a sworn statement in the Army's report on Dez, one of the medical staffers told him, "Go the F away." When Dez tested positive for strep, no one bothered to notify him. As Dez was losing the ability to walk, a drill sergeant called him a weak pussy in front of his fellow trainees. The Del Barbas say it was only after Dez was rushed to the ER that Fort Benning Command took the steps to realize that indeed it had an epidemic of strep on base. Hundreds of trainees were infected. They knew Dez tested positive for strep, Camney told me. All they had to do was call him to come in and administer the shot. All they had to do was give him the basic standard of care. In March 2019, an Army spokesman told local news outlets the base had worked to combat the strep outbreak, including spending $1.7 million on antibiotics. "We take these unfortunate incidents very seriously and actively review our training regulations and procedures to prevent other serious incidents from occurring in the future," the spokesperson said. Infuriated, the Del Barbas reached out to attorneys to file a lawsuit. "We wanted people held accountable," Camney told me. Every lawyer they spoke with informed the Delbarbas that they had no legal standing to file a case against the military or against any of those in its employ because of something called the Fears Doctrine. Very few people outside, or for that matter, inside the United States military, have ever heard of the Fears Doctrine or have any idea that current law denies active duty service members the ability to sue their employer in civil court. Most of those who are familiar with Fears have encountered it either because they are a service member who was a victim of an injury caused by military negligence, or because they are family of a service member wrongfully killed in non-combat related circumstances. The doctrine, which takes its name from a 1950 Supreme Court ruling, prevents service members from suing the federal government for any alleged wrongful injury or death that occurs incident to service. There is a lot packed into Fears, especially that last phrase, incident to service. Every year, according to a 2016 study co-authored by a doctor at Johns Hopkins University, medical errors cause approximately 251,000 patient deaths, which represent about 9.5% of all deaths in the United States. That study is seminal and hotly debated because there has been almost no other scholarly research on the subject. A 9.5% rate of fatality means medical malpractice is a leading cause of death in the U.S., killing more Americans than strokes, accidents, or Alzheimer's. Consequently, every year, some 20,000 medical malpractice lawsuits are filed in the United States. Meanwhile, in the U.S. military, which counts 1.4 million members, the annual average number of medical malpractice lawsuits that active duty military personnel file against military health care providers is practically zero. Just like in the civilian world, medical staff in the military make mistakes, and there is negligence that sometimes causes harm or death, categorized as sentinel events. According to the most recent data available, from 2014 through 2018, there were a total of 657 sentinel events, an average of 131 per year. The publicly available data doesn't make a distinction between injuries and deaths. According to those figures, that would mean less than a tenth of 1% of active duty military members are harmed or killed by medical treatment and military care. Those statistics almost certainly underreport the actual number of sentinel events. In 2018, the Government Accountability Office concluded the military's tracking process for sentinel events was fragmented and inconsistent, and as a result, impeded complete information about sentinel events. The history of the Fears Doctrine reads both as a quirk of American jurisprudence and one continually unfolding injustice that traces its way back to the waning days of World War II. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.